Welcome back to Red Ice, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Henrik. Hope you guys are doing well. We have an interesting show for you guys today. Our guest is Jonas Nilsson, who is with us to talk about his latest book, Anarcho-Fascism, Nature Reborn. I've had the pleasure of going through the book over the last 24 hours or so, 48 hours actually, and there's a lot of new ideas in the book. There's also a lot of tribute to classic themes. Excellent book. It's divided up into three main sections. It's the lie, the war, and the state. And I want to ask Jonas more about this later on, of course. So I'm looking forward to diving into this. But welcome, Jonas. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Henrik. I'm very glad to be on the show.
Excellent. So let's talk about just yourself a little bit first, if you don't mind. How did you end up writing the book? You, of course, have a degree in political science. I think you're writing you're doing your master's right now. Is this your first book?
It's my second book that I wrote myself, and I'm part in an anthology with some other authors. So, if you count that, it would be my third. The idea for this book actually is born out of the bachelor thesis that I did when I graduated at the National Defense University for my political science degree, where the thesis were regarding the Trump presidency and the campaign to it, how he managed to, under one umbrella, gather different views of the political system that, under normal circumstances, are in a contradiction to each other. And therefore, most is libertarians, anarcho-capitalists, but also what would be called in popular culture for like right-wing extremist fascist. And that contradiction of those certain political ideas and how you view society and the reason of society, how they could be under the same banner, what caught my interest and was the subject of my thesis. And that was also what was developed later into this book, which I then named after these two political ideas of anarchism and fascism and the submersion together.
Yeah, you begin the book by talking about, as you said, the rise of Trump, and also how it seems that a lot of these libertarians or more even anarcho-libertarians, more free market kind of people, were attracted to him for obviously for their own reason, but also a lot of people on the right and the new right and the alt-right was attracted to him as well. So he really became like a unifying force, because if you look at the title, it might seem contradictory at first, right? And what can fascism, that is all about authoritarianism and control, possibly have to do with anarchism, right?
Yeah, exactly. So what that put these two groups together wasn't necessarily the identity that we are one and same. It is like a forced collision where it's the mutual interest from these different groups that actually collide and emerged into what was in the Trump campaign. And if you look into the history of the Republican Party, which differs quite much from the Swedish political system, where we have seven parties in our parliament. And if you only have a two-party system, that would be two bigger umbrellas on each side of the political spectrum. So in the Republican Party, you have the Tea Party movement, and you still have some conservative, and you got the pro-life, and lots of right-wing Christians with pretty traditional values. So what happens is, you could say that the failure of, for instance, candidates like Ron Paul and Pat Buchanan, which has been in different spectrum inside the party and haven't become mainstream in the Republican Party and have been outmaneuvered by the so-called neocons. And those two failures was representing each stream in one way or another, made them come together in one mutual candidate that was, in this case, Trump.
So tell us a bit about the subtitle to Nature Reborn. I mean, this has been a topic, of course, which I was been very, very interested in. But the issue of modernity and where we are today in the West is one that is very problematic, obviously. And I've always seen the kind of empty consumerism and to a certain extent, capitalism as a very detrimental aspect to our existence and to the problem of Western man, if you will. But how do you what do you mean when you talk about the nature reborn? Tell us about that a little bit.
Nature reborn can be traced back to what I would call for political anthropology, that politics and theory is something that needs to derive from what we are and not necessarily from what we wish to be. And that's the main problem in the Western world and in Sweden in particular. And you can see it also arrive in America, especially with the social justice work, the idea of social constructivism. And this gets life in the public discourse and especially in the media outlets that gets more fire from the social justice warrior. And that's also the interesting with the concept of theory. When I started to work with my exam paper, I regarded first something that was happening in real life. I regarded anarcho-capitalism and I regarded fascism, both supporting Trump, and looked on the different policies from the different political theory and how they made their case for why Trump needed to win and how they could collude together. A social construct do the other way around. They start first with the theoretical construction and then try to enforce it into the real world. So nature reborn is the gravity force of what we are as human and all political reforms that contradicts our nature as man will undoubtedly be gravitated back when the force of the state is too weak to maintain the so-called, you could call it the false answer in the culture sense or a lie, or it doesn't matter how you want to frame it. But the point is that the answer that the social constructivist gives us that we want to live after collides very badly with human nature. And that is a breeding ground for a potential disaster. When we are still on the topic about the political anthropology, all serious political theorists take some stance. And this is interesting because of the concept of anarcho-fascism. Liberal theorists like John Locke, for instance, John Mill, have implicitly a regard of human nature that man is good and therefore we need to be set free and we flourish in a free market society. And fascist thinkers like Thomas Hobbes or Carl Schmitt regard us not necessarily as evil, but as oberäkneliga.
Unpredictable.
As an unpredictable species, which means that we need to be controlled. Because if we were 100% evil or 100% good, we would know where we had each other. But the unpredictability in our nature makes us to need to have some kind of control functions in society. And it's here where the arise of the law and why we should have a law takes its place. And for the liberal thinkers, we need an objective law that is the same for all and is the same in every different situation. And one of the Carl Schmitt's criticisms against that is because every situation is not perceivable, so we can't have a fixed objective law. The law needs to be arised in the situations. So the state needs to be both inside the law and outside the law at the same time. And that is the problem with liberal democracy. And that's the why liberals despise fascism, because it's the reality check just on that point.
This is actually very interesting in terms of, you know, the studies that you've done on in the field of political science. Is there any honest discussion about what fascism actually is? Does that ever come into the picture and they objectively, I guess, even try to understand it?
No, it doesn't. And that's a big lie from the liberal democracy society, that we think that we live in a society with an objective law, with universal values. And in some sense, we do. But even in Sweden, the Swedish government we have a constitution in Sweden, and to maintain that constitution, in the constitution it says that we doesn't need to take the constitution in consideration if the situation requires it. So we are under the same principles, but we are cheating ourselves that we are not. And that is problematic, because that is cheating us to that we are something that we are not.
Right, because, you know, the issue of fascism is always very interesting, because I feel we never really get to truly kind of try to understand what it is. It's just been so vehemently demonized. So when you use the term on the book, are you trying to reach for it in the objective sense of what it really was, or is it more that you're using it kind of, I don't know, tongue in cheek, in the way that the liberals are kind of using it today as a slur? Or how did you end up using the term?
I'm not using it in the Mussolini sense of a way, due to the anarchic the anarchic part of the title fills a function, and that function is that my political theory that is presented in the book rests on a premise, and that premise is that a free market society is beneficial and flourishing for a people, a political unit, which could be a tribe, a nation. And it may be not necessary for it itself if we were living in a vacuum, but we are not. We are living in separation from other groups. And if we deliver bad answer of how we deal with our production inside society and how we deal with each other, we will be a weak position in competition to those other groups.
Right. So tell us a bit more about how you would describe this as someone who really fears the concept, right? Who truly thinks that this is the most evil, wicked, dangerous thing that ever has existed. How would you try to rationalize to them that there is political ideas here that have merit and that they're interesting and stuff like that? Is that something you've done in your work so far?
Yeah, a little bit, partly when I defended the thesis, but it's based on voluntarism. In its true sense, in some way, if you connect it back to anthropology, if you go back to the political theories that takes the stance about if human nature is good and evil, what they have never really put the finger on is also the gender issue of male and masculinity and femininity. And the reason why they haven't really done it is because it's not have been a societal problems in the past as it has been today. Sweden today, for instance, has the first world feminine government, and there is reason to that. And one of those reasons is because we have had 200 years of complete peace and isolation to that degree that we don't even think that men is what we needed to protect our country.
Right.
And if you go back to human nature and political anthropology, I can really recommend David Gilmour's cross-culture study, Manhood in the Making, where he identified three archetypes of manhood that is in all societies. And what cultures can do is either enforce this so they light up stronger, or they can be decreased. And when they are strongest is when the society is in an environment of threat. And if it flourishes with resources and is a low threat society, it's a window of opportunity of feminism. And the danger with feminism, and you forget why we have men in society, which is to protect the tribe, is that our tribe stand protectless. And that's the danger with it. So one idea that I put forward in the book is that of criticism of Immanuel Kant's perpetual peace, and say that this is the problem we have with the perpetual peace, partially because we forget that politics is conflict, and conflict is conflict management. And for that, you need different groups that try to work after their own interests. And you can't have a conflict if you can't have the means of violence, that if it's underlying threat of pure violence. And if you forget that, it will just be delusional. And you can play that for a time until some group which have the means of power start to play by other rules than just the counting methods that we have now today in this democracy. So the fundamental with the idea is that I think it's fair to say that empirically the strongest society in the world today is America, and the reason why it is because of its capitalistic and libertarian principle, which is its founded. But why it's in a downhill today is because they have not been able to maintain those values, and it's been turning out to go to in a socialistic standard which is more inclined with Europe. And you may be not there today, but you definitely will be. And that's why anarchists and anarcho-capitalists and fascists merge together under Trump, because if libertarian and anarchists really value their freedom, they must realize that they can't invite a people, for instance, the Mexicans, which in a much bigger degree vote democratic, which is an incitement for the for your future America, that it will be less free with more gun control and higher taxes or whatever. And the only reason to maintain it is to value your own in-group tribe. So that's the idea with anarcho-fascism, that it's based on the free market principle, but the regulating factor is not by majority vote, it's of the fascia, the Mannerbund, the man that puts the price into conflict, because conflict management, if it's rest upon the means of violence, it's not the females that will pay the price for that, it's the men in the group, and therefore right. The men of the group has the responsibility to take charge in that field, mainly.
That's very interesting, you know, because if we compare then, or if we just talk about Sweden a little bit in general, I agree with you. I think that due to the partial success, I guess, material success, maybe political success, it could be argued that Sweden, of course, come from, you know, before we went over to a more socialistic system, we did have a free market and the economy kind of got going in that way. I don't think if we didn't have the industrialization and this stuff, we wouldn't never have been able to go in a socialistic direction. But it's, I always put it this way, it's partially the success, the material and political success that led Sweden to become weakened to a certain extent, right? And as you say, the kind of feminism we see today in Sweden is kind of it's an offshoot of them just not realizing that the world out there is one of real conflicts and struggle. And there is war and enemies and things like this. And we've kind of been isolated in a bubble to a certain extent. And now, of course, through mass migration and through other, you know, terrorist groups and this kind of thing, we're for the first time in a long period begin to see what it is like not having a strong defense and a strong, I guess, masculine ruled government, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you're perfectly right. Our industrialization, our free market economy before the socialization after the Second World War took place for real in the 60s and 70s. That was the breeding ground for what made socialism possible. And that is in line with David Gilmour's theory in Man and in the Making, that an excess of resources and a lack of threat is the opportunity window of feminism. Sweden is the perfect example of that. And now we're paying the price because we have no distinction in-group and out-group preferences. Because if we did, that would be the realization of a conflict. So we're trying to remove the concept of politics as a whole, to regard it as not as a means of providing our group our interest in considering to other groups, because that makes the conflict real, because it's materialized. So what we do is we deny our own in-group and include the out-group and try to create politics in quote together, which is by definition impossible, partly because we have an opposition in Sweden which is not in line with this, which in their own words, creates an us and them society. but also those that we include to our society is not inclined with that political decision either, that we are in this together. They are working after their own interest and creating their own political units that working against us. And our liberal government denies this, and they denies it so hard because the reason why they are here is because of this delusion that we are in the same boat, which we are not.
Right. Yeah, so many things there that you've mentioned that we can go into detail about. But yeah, this, I always wondered, is it that they're denying that conflict isn't, is it part of the equation here? I'm talking about the political establishment and many people on the left and the liberal democratic order. Are they just simply denying that, you know, that society is conflict ridden? Or is it that they're so afraid of it that they're refusing to recognize that and actually looking the other way?
It's a feminization. Of course, they're afraid of it and looking the other way. And the only way they can be part of politics is to, as Hillary Clinton said during the campaign, stronger together. They can't divide, because in the division, you need to have the threat of violence. And in the feminist conflict management, violence is not one of the tools. They have many tools. Tend and befriend is the tool we see in Sweden that is being used, which means that we try to, in the no-go zones in the Stockholm suburbans and Malmö suburbans and the Gothenburg suburbans, is for our police force not to enforce the law, but to go out and try to befriend this immigrant that is rioting.
I mean, it's laughable, right? They have dialogue police. They send the dialogue police to try to... For them, it's not really, I mean, I'm not saying this is true maybe across the board. Sure, there might be some people in these areas that want to, I don't know, get into Swedish society or something like this. They see some kind of, they're kind of sucked into the liberal democratic propaganda and think that we can sort this out together. But I think it's generally true that for most, this is still for them a territorial dispute. They see this as them gaining not only resources, but territory. They're conquering this in the name of a religion. I'm talking about Islam, obviously. It's just us who are just not, I'm saying generally Swedes, just don't have that awareness. They're so dumb and naive and deluded that they think that we're going to solve this by talking to them or offering them jobs and apartments and they'll become just like us, right?
Yeah, that's the thing. We are a territorial species, and the liberal left is denying the existence of no-go zone. But the thing is, you can have a political science definition of what a no-go zone is. For instance, where there is a different sovereignty, where they decide their own exceptions of the rules. But it's also biologically, if you go into an area and you don't feel safe, it's your biology that tells you you're not in your own territory. You put up your guard in a different way where you are at home, where your territory should be. And if you're walking in your country, no matter time or day, you should not have that biological chemistry in your body that says that you're in a threat area, which I assure you every Swede have if they walk into the wrong area at the wrong time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's a very good point. I think that the role of violence have been very important throughout, you know, human civilization. It's been key. It's been the things that have shaped, to a certain extent, civilization. And us now denying these basic modalities is, of course, leading to the downfall. I remember someone talking about, it was a very interesting comment, it was about the success of matriarchal societies. And they said the reason why we don't find them in the record of them as being, or even having them prolonged being successful enough, long enough in the historical record, is because they were simply conquered by a patriarchal one, a neighbor maybe even, right?
Yeah, and that's where my prediction with Sweden is. Sweden will be the most patriarchal country in Europe, if not the world, because of the pendulum in society that will swing from one side to the other. And it's up to us Swedish men to make sure that the patriarchal society is ruled by us and not the Muslims, because that's the number two guys on the line. And as it is now, we are losing because we are not fighting, and they are, and our state is definitely not fighting. at least not with us.
No, I was going to say they're fighting against us. They're actually, if we did things right, if we tried to step into the situation, you and us, and restore law and restore order and all these things, I think our own military and police would actually be deployed against us, right?
Yes, they definitely would. And that's why the critique is against us, that the liberal left is calling us warmonger or the divider of society, because we make the politics real against. We acknowledge that we have a threat in society that the liberal left is ignoring. And by ignoring something doesn't make it disappear. And by us for pointing this out, makes the delusional from the left to realize that if the right is right, which we are, then we can't do the politics together. Then we need to make the distinction between friend and foe.
At what point can we begin to charge them both morally, but also for irresponsibility and negligence over the fact that they have, I mean, they have largely, what they have solely actually created the situation that we are in today with the kind of crime that we see in Sweden, the rape epidemic, the negligence of the elderly and the young and things like this. Economically, the nation has been ruined. I would argue that they can charge us maybe more directly for wanting to have, in their view, some kind of violence for having law and order and protecting ourselves. But in their worldview, there is a much greater violence at the end of their system, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Normally, you can say that when you go into the field of politics, you have two costs. First, you have a negotiations cost, where you put the political decision up for discussion. And the reason why you do that is that you want to limit the external cost of the political decision. And the external cost is the opposition, those people that is not on board with the political decision. And those people are, by definition, almost where the political is attacking. And if we don't put any cost into that equation, there does not exist an external cost, because we need to make that real. We need to make it alive. And that's the problem with it. And that will also be the essence of Nature Reborn, that the protection of society rests upon men. The state is purely a scale, a skull that we fill with men to not just control the aggression of men, so we can actually have a society that doesn't burn up in an inferno, but also to channelize it to do something constructive. And we have eliminating both of them. So what we see now in the streets of Stockholm and Gothenburg is non-controlled male from different parts of the world, mostly the MENA country, the Middle East and North Africa. And we don't have any Swedish male to protect our women, mostly. And that was what the outcry was roughly 1.5-2 years ago, when the local football hooligan firms actually went out together, different firms that fight each other in the normal circumstances, makes an exception to how they do things, and doing gemensam effort.
Yeah, like a co-joint effort to try to restore. Was it like a march for against the kind of violence that we've seen, or what was it?
The media that framed the co-joint operation from these two hooligan firms as an attack at the Central Station in Stockholm, where they tried to, in quote, clean house from the American North African so-called kids that has been harassing women and ladies. Mm-hmm. And this is what we will see more and more, not just in Sweden, but in the Western world in total, where the state not just fails, because fails implies that you actually try, but where the state ignores the problems that lies upon its citizens. And when they do it, it's up for this citizen. And then I'm talking about male citizen, because that's what it's all about. Will step up and take that responsibility themselves. And that's the symbolism of the fascia, the symbol of actual fascism, which makes the law subjective and not objective. this is a subjective action.
Right. And here's some of the footage that they were talking about. I remember the story now, of course. Yeah, the media termed it that this was somehow just a big violent act or something like that. I think that they've been handing out flyers too, where they basically said, like, it's enough now. We're not going to take this anymore. There's a huge and strong presence of these, football groups and supporter groups in Sweden and other countries too in Europe. Is that something that's ever? I mean, those are kind of a männerbund in a way, right? They're built on a little bit of an ancient structure. Do you ever think that those people would kind of come to our side, if you will, politically? Because I remember reading about the different firms, as we call it in Sweden. For those who are not familiar with this is basically supporter groups that go out and they fight each other, basically, and they claim that they're not political. They claim that they're basically in a situation where they don't care about, issues of politics and stuff like that. But what do you think, Jonas? Could we ever get some of them on our side, if you will?
I think some of them, some of the firms will and some will not. And that's the thing with the Mannerbunds. It's not for us to decide, it's for them. But one thing that I think you can say pretty certain is that they will take part in the fight, and which side they choose is purely on their internal culture and their interests. And when it comes to the Swedish-born firms, which is have a homogenetical to the race of the Swedes, yes, they will definitely be part of the politics when it's time to act. And when you have a tribal society, if we're gonna call this hooligans a form of society, a Mannerbund, that's what makes some force into their decision. When they decide to act, they can enforce it in a different way. And we saw that in Ukraine as well. It's very, very easy to transfer a structure which you already had built up for one purpose to transfer it to another. And that is what these two hooligan firms did on their stay at Stockholm Central. And this is... they're giving politics the politic life in one sense. You could say that we have a political structure and the domestic politic is what we do instead of having a civil war. We vote instead of fight. And for that to work, the outcome of the vote need to reflect the potential of violence of the different groups. We look at the votes and we say, okay, that Mannerbund is too strong for us to overcome in this political decision because they are more than us, they are stronger. And if we're going to fight in a symmetrical war, we will lose. We can always turn asymmetric and see what's happened. But that's not the point. The point is, if you add to that equation people who are not in physical shape to fight and let them vote, and they vote in an interest that goes against those who have the means of violence, it's you only... you're delaying the political decision, which could result in either a war or a revolution.
Yeah.
And this is the real frightening development that you can particularly see in Sweden. If you look at the different age groups of how they vote, we have the older generation who vote like traditionally what we are used to in our 7-party political system. We have the right party, which is like center-right, and we have the left party, which is pretty much center-left. It's not much difference between them. And if you go down two age groups, if I consider myself to be above it, so we're talking about the early 20s and the late teens, with a broad pencil, the girls are voting for the far-left extreme feminist party called Feministic Initiative, and the male group is voting for the Swedish Democrat, and those two parties is in a diametrical opposition to each other. And if it were to happen out, which it actually looks now, that the Swedish Democrat will be the biggest party in Sweden and also have the biggest male votes of all the parties, but we're still ruled by a feminist government, which is enforced by 18 up to 30-year-old women. You don't need to put a lot of thought of that to see that this cannot be maintained. The only reason why it's maintained is in the the agreement of the political system that we are in. And it's just enough with one group to change the agreement and change the rules to according to that owns group's ability to enforce its interests. And here's the dangerous part, is that it's non-compromissible. We are not prepared to compromise about the existence of our people, and they are not prepared to compromise with us because we are so-called Nazis or fascism. And that is a very, very dangerous path that can only go one way, in my mind. And that is not where we want to go.
But isn't that, though, I mean, if you look at civilization and history and political science, even political history, this is a cyclical issue almost, right? I mean, if most societies kind of return back to some state of I shouldn't really call it brutality, but just like a kind of a zero point again. We reach a point where basically this is success of the society. It either collapses under its own weight, either due to corruption or the success to a certain extent, and it becomes decadent, and then eventually it falls apart. And then out of those ashes, usually, not always, but usually kind of a stronger unified force kind of arises out. This is what I'm saying, is that isn't this just kind of inevitable in the history of the cyclical nature to politics?
Yes, in one sense it is, and that's a little bit of the concept of nature reborn, that a society that gets strong enough so we can enforce politics that's not in line with human nature will eventually fall back into its own nature when the external, either the external or internal cost gets too high, so they can't no longer maintain it. And then we have a natural revival of what we are. And that is what is normally considered as a cycle.
Very good. I'm looking forward to that. I think we have to go in that direction, you know, because it's been not only decadent for such a long time, but it's been no real structure and sense to things in Sweden, frankly. And I think we were talking a little bit before we started that Sweden might also become kind of a country that is exemplary in the resistance to globalization. Potentially, it could go either way. I mean, let's be honest about this. We have, I think, a group in Sweden that would be happy to take over, you know, the government functions, the territory, the resources, etc. And considering that we have people pouring in from countries such as Libya and Syria, Iraq, other North African countries, they would be equipped in, for example, guerrilla warfare, right? They would be equipped in asymmetrical warfare. They would be, obviously, at this stage, much better equipped than your normal average Swede when it comes to, like, a violent conflict that would erupt or some kind of internal civil strife, right? On the other hand, so that's one possibility. They might just take over the show if we don't watch our backs here. And then the other possibility here is, of course, that we have enough time to build momentum of a resistance to this, where we can not only take care of the internal problems of our own government, but also kind of the external threat that has been imported by our globalist friends and their policies. But how do you see that dynamic? What do you think is going to play out there between these rival factions?
I think first one one needs to point out that the immigration group is not one political unit; it's several. So even though we, as a white people, become a minority in our own country, we would still be the strongest political unit around. That mentioned is that it's not a white pill in that sense, because it's a very serious situation, and if we do nothing, we will lose by sure. So it's a race against the clock. If we do slow paced, it's just a matter of time. For instance, before France put in Islam as an official religion next to Christianity. It's a natural process as things develop. And that we need to be very cautious and prepared for. And what we know for certain is that our liberal establishment will not be able to deal with that, because they deal with these people as individual. If this group were to turn to guerrilla warfare, which they have in one sense with their terrorist attacks on Europe's streets and squares, they regard them as acts of individual and not acts of groups. And what we need to do as an opposition is to start to inflict a cost to that politics to make sure that we change the angle of the narrative. And I think the best answer for us to do that is to create our own exception in a semi-legal way, where we, if we're going to take like a poor example, like the hooligan firms, we are both part of society, but we're also outside it. We are under our own moral law and not accepting this state-enforced cost of immigration. Not quietly, at least.
Exactly. You know, and as you're talking about this, I want to mention as well that it looks like, I mean, obviously Muslims would vote as a democratic bloc, but then, of course, you have Sunni and Shia conflicts. You have different subgroups. We've seen, for example, Kurds and Turks fighting on the streets of Germany, where German police have to get in there and try to restore order. It's very chaotic. So definitely it's not, you know, homogenous in that sense, and they're all going to get along. They might get along up to a certain point, which would be maybe to topple the majority, the native population. But wouldn't you say that they would use our democratic process? This is what's so funny about the situation, that I think many of these other groups, that will use a democratic process as they're becoming a majority to ultimately remove the democratic process, right? That the liberal democratic order doesn't realize that everyone that's coming in doesn't want that liberal order, and they don't see it the same way. They would, in fact, use it to turn it into, you know, political Islam or something like that. And this is what they don't get, this, right?
Yeah. This is very crazy. I want to take two things. But first, with the first one, they accept this radical Islams, and we have jihadist Muslims from all over the world, in Sweden, mostly North African and Middle Easterns, that goes to Syria, fight the war, and come back to Sweden. And we accept that. And we accept that with the motivation that we will indoctrinate them back into liberal society. And they actually believe that they can do that.
It's insane that they think that they'll be able to convert them. It's never going to happen.
Yeah. And this is what I want to tell to them. I'm a born Swedish man. I live in this society. If you are not able to indoctrinate me, which has the same racial identity as you have, how are you going to indoctrinate this foreigner who doesn't even identify as a Swede into the Swedish society? Start to indoctrinate your political opposition, and maybe we can have peace in this country. Because your path now leads only one way, and that's to more terrorism and to more division and to a more political society, which by sure is one of them and one of us, and it will never be together. And the other thing is a political unit is political arrives in the collision of interests. So one political unit is a group that works after its interest, but the glue that put these groups together is its identity. And we have a perfect example on a low level in Sweden what could happen on a higher abstract level, and that is in the municipal policy. We have a large, for instance, a large Christian Syrian groups, which definitely not are Muslims or friends with the Muslim, and they have fled from Muslim countries. But still, some of our areas, I can mention two municipalities, that of Sigtuna and that of Södertälje, is not run in the municipality. It's run in the Orthodox Church of the Syrians. Mm-hmm. And how can that be? It's because they put their own group's interest first, no matter which party they represent in the municipality. So you will have Syrians in the Social Democratic Party, Syrians in the Moderate Party, and they will collide with each other on their own identity. We are being played, and we are being played good.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, it's very interesting. There's new dynamics that's going to arise out of this. And you know, part of me too, you know, feels that, you know, good riddance with this liberal democratic order. Because, I mean, if this, the fruits of it, is what we can see in front of us today, then surely it's nothing to save. It's nothing to to try to protect and preserve. I mean, I understand people that are concerned with, like, you know, Western values and all this kind of stuff, but I go a step further in that and say, you know what, I don't want to preserve a system that has brought us the kind of world that we live in today. That's not my concern anyway. I'm concerned with going back, you know, to try to preserve something which is more old and ancient and traditional, which is more
that's
worth.
The thing. This is not a fault that we have now. It's a systematical fault. The fault is in our political structure. If this were to happen in the old days, where we actually had a king, it would just enough to be to kill one person, and that would be the king. Now we need to kill an entire system, and that will be much harder, and it will be much more blood.
Yeah.
And that doesn't mean blood in camps. It will be blood, sweat, and tears. It will be more work and more suffering in whatever way it will manifest.
So do you see this as a kind of a rebirth process, though? I mean, again, as I said, it seems that after a certain set of time, there just seems to be a kind of a decadence that sets in, and we find some way of bringing new challenges to us, even if we actually import them into our own countries. But surely, I mean, just from a philosophical point of view, isn't it good to an extent that we get challenged in the way that we do, and the fact that this is an opportunity for growth as well? I mean, as I said, I go back to that point. I see two things here. One is, I'm positive over the fact that the system as it currently exists is being challenged to the point of where it probably is not going to exist maybe in, I don't know, 20 years from now, maybe even earlier, maybe a little later. I'm not sure. That's a good thing. And the second point to this is that it's a good thing that we get finally challenged in a country like Sweden, where it's been so peaceful that we've just become so naive to the realities of the world and nature and how things really operate, that this is an opportunity for us to revitalize ourselves and get back in touch with what the essence of life itself, and the fact that it is built on conflict, and it's nothing ugly or negative in that process. This is just nature itself, and we have to get back in tune with that. I just see this is just nature realigning us, bringing us back into line again, basically.
Yeah, and I don't think it's an accident that lots of the liberal thinkers and political theorists are islanders, which have an island mentality, and an island, which Scandinavia also is a high trust society where you trust your neighbor and you think the best of people, which is different a lot from the continental thinkers of, for instance, Nietzsche, which has a different touch with reality. Germany centered on the continents have been fighting invaders from the beginning of time. While when we have been fighting, has been first going on a boat and on a raid. And when we're back home, we're pretty safe. And when that goes over time, we started to get delusional and think, okay, we're safe. So that means other people are safe because other people are like us. But here's the surprise. They're not like us. They're predators. And just now we're the prey, and we need to become the predators ourselves, which we once were. And that is for certain a game changer and a rebirth of nature, a rebirth of manhood, that we become the beasts that we actually are. And what makes society work is that we're controlled beasts, that this
right.
Control our aggression and channelize it in the right direction.
Yeah, good point. Very interesting perspective. So I want to ask you more about this in the second part here coming up about equality. And maybe there is some kind of lesson, obviously referring to the Viking Age with the raids and all this kind of stuff. There's always been an extremism to a certain extent in the Scandinavian countries. Denmark less so because of the fact that they're tied to the continent. I'm not sure, but nonetheless, Norway, Sweden, very extreme, it's extreme environments, you know, really, it can be really hot summers and very cold winters, a lot of, you know, we live in extremes, and to a certain extent, occasionally our mentality has been reflected of those extremes as well. There's something there. I want to ask you more about that in a second, but what I want to mention to the audience as well is that the book is at the time of the recording, not yet out in English, but it is going to be released shortly, probably within, what do you think, Jonas, a month or so within this interview being recorded?
End of August, it should be out.
And of course, the best place to go and get the book is on logik.se or logic.se, which is the publisher. It will be an English version. Let me pull out the page here. There will be an English version available here, but it also will be available to Amazon. And you mentioned, Jonas, it would probably be better for people in non-European countries to order it from Amazon just because of the shipping costs.
Yeah, probably because it's on print on demand and Amazon prints it locally if you're in America, for instance.
Very good. So again, the title is Anarcho-Fascism, Nature Reborn. Definitely look out for that. And we're going to have links up to the book, of course, when it's out and available. All right, folks, we're going to take a short break here at the end of the first segment and continue with Jonas Nilsson in the second. A lot more to discuss and a lot more to talk about. If you want to check that out, please head on over to redicemembers.com. That is our members website. That is how we run and function with this operation. We don't have ads or any commercials or anything like that. We are listener supported. And if you do sign up with us for a membership, you get full access to our archives. We have by now over 1,400 different shows and videos and entries on the members' website. Tons of stuff there for you over a 10-year period. A lot of different things from our start that we were interested in and our own transformation over to more alt-right topics in the last 2-3 years or so. So there's a lot of good stuff there for you to go through if you're so inclined and interested. So yeah, stay tuned. We'll be right back with the second segment. We'll talk to you on the other side.